From Michigan Radio, this is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Today, Iraqi immigrants detained for months by ICE, being released by a judge's order, and fighting to keep from being sent back to Iraq.
I could have been probably just killed and thrown on the side of the road somewhere because of the fact that no one is going to ask any questions about this Christian being dead.
Democracy on Fast Forward, creating a new authority to oversee a Line 5 tunnel.
The legislature quickly passed it. The governor quickly signed it 45 minutes after the House did its final action. And by the next day, the governor had appointed three people to serve on this authority.
Plus, kids' apps loaded with ads pressuring young consumers.
If a child wasn't making the in-app purchase, the character showed some emotional reaction or some disapproval.
Those stories and much more for you today on Stateside. Hello and welcome to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Today brings the first meeting of the Mackinac Straits Corridor Authority. That's the body meant to oversee construction of the controversial tunnel beneath the Straits of Mackinac. This body was formed last week. The public comment period has come and gone, and the authority is expected to move forward with the tunnel agreement today.
As far as government work, this is absolutely warp speed.
More to come on that later in the program. But first, this should be homecoming week for some 100 Iraqi immigrants who've been detained by U.S. Immigration and Customs Enforcement since summer of 2017. Federal Judge Mark Goldsmith has ordered ICE to let them go by tomorrow, December 20th. And then he tore into the government, saying it made false statements to justify keeping the Iraqis locked up indefinitely. Usama Hamama of West Bloomfield is known to all as Sam. He was taken in that nationwide mass roundup of some 1,400 people, and then he was released last February after posting bond. He's the lead plaintiff in the case that led to Judge Goldsmith's order, and he is with us now. Sam, you came to this country when you were how old?
I was 4 years old when I came to the country, 1966.
What reason did ICE give you when you were detained and they tried to send you back to Iraq?
I had an order of deportation and that I must leave this country.
And why was that?
In 1986, I committed a crime which was basically scaring someone with a gun. And I did 2 years for it. And I never complained about that because I thought that was wrong, what I did. And I served my time. I came out. I've been left alone ever since. Till 2014, they came knocking on my door one day and took me away downtown and fingerprinted me and let me go. And the next time I saw them, well, I reported every year. But in between that, they picked me up on June 11th, 2017.
And you were detained for 8 months. Where were you detained, Sam?
I was detained at St. Clair County Jail.
And what were the conditions like?
You know, I'll be honest with you. I was next to a rapist, I was next to a murderer, child molesters, all kinds of people. And I just, you know, like I said, in my 2 years of doing time, I did not complain, but this was I could not understand why I had to be detained with people of sort next to me, sleeping next to me for 8 months and having to deal with their issues and, you know, and really felt unsafe and uncomfortable to be in a place like that.
Were you able to see your family? Were you able to be in touch with lawyers?
Lawyers were available whenever they wanted to come and see me. That was not a problem. My family was, you get a half hour a week, per week, 1/2 hour behind a glass that's about 6 inches thick, basically. And you spoke through the glass, and you pretty much read lips is what you did, because there was no communication line between that glass. Literally just you wave or you scream real loud so they can hear you or you can hear them. That was just half hour every week. That's it.
Now, how did that time that you were away, that 8 months, how did that affect your wife and your four children?
You know, let me be honest with you. Every child needs a father and a mother. This is just a simple thing. Every person, every son, every daughter needs a father and a mother. And for 8 months there, my wife was the mom and the dad. And knowing where their dad was, it just did not, they couldn't understand why. You know, it's okay if I was dead. It's okay if I was sick and in a hospital, but being in jail and walking around knowing that, I don't know how they left a smile on their face, but they did their best. And it was really gut-wrenching when you hear that your son says, I don't know how we're going to make money, so I'm going to drop out of high school to go get a job to help my mom pay the bills. That just tore me apart as the breadwinner of the house. I am. That's who brings the check in.
And meantime, as that's going on, there's the threat of being deported to Iraq. What do you think would have happened to you if that had happened and you had been sent back to Iraq?
The way the system works there is when if you come into a country, they don't know who you are. They will, you know, incarcerate you right away. They will not just let you go out into the public because their fear is you could be an American. You're also a Christian that's not really welcomed in that country because they look down on Christianity. I could have been jailed for life. I could have been probably just killed and thrown on the side of the road somewhere because of the fact that no one is going to ask any questions about this Christian being dead. So it could have been anybody's. I could have been anybody's target. Anyone that wanted to hurt me, maybe take me for ransom, put me in prison somewhere. The possibilities were endless, to be honest with you.
If you just joined us, we are talking with Sam Hamama, who was one of the hundreds of Iraqi immigrants who were detained by ICE in the summer of 2017. Sam, you got out in February. How did that happen? How were you able to get released?
Judge Goldsmith granted us bond, and I was one of the lucky ones to get bond because I was not a threat. I was a threat, but the judge looked at it different. He thought I wasn't a threat because for 30 years I haven't done anything wrong, 34 years basically. And I had some ties in the community, strong ties, wife, kids, owned a house. I have a job to go to. So those are some of the things they looked at. And then they gave me $100,000 bond. So I was a lucky one. I was one of the lucky ones that came out.
And what happened with your job?
Well, to be honest with you, I have a job. I do. I went back, right, resumed my job the next day, literally. I took a day off, and then from there I started again. I thank these people that I work with, and they kept my job going. Actually, one of my partners that works with me literally did double shift every day for 8 months till I finally got back. He would not accept any help from anybody. He worked hard day and night just to keep my position open, never asked for help, and that's how I kept my job, basically.
And Sam, since you got out in February and you were able to make bond, have you been able to make your case in immigration court? Where does it stand for you?
So a couple of days ago, about a week ago, I was in immigration court in front of Judge Peru, and they gave me a court date of 2020, January 14th, 2020. They're going to hear my 212C, which, again, I'm lucky to be able to get that granted by the government so that I can, you know, let them hear my case, show them that I've only made one mistake in my life, and to hopefully give me a second chance. So January 14th, 2020. I go back in front of the judge.
And what is a 212C?
It's basically someone that's committed a crime before 1996 and only committed one crime in their life. And they will let you apply for it and let a judge hear it, and the judge will decide. Nothing is in stone. I'm not saying that it's going to happen 100%, but I'm saying I have a very good chance of staying in this country.
Sam, what have you been hearing from the others who did not get out when you got out in February, the others who've been held?
Hardship on their families, very, very hardship. People have lost their homes, businesses. Wives have decided, you know, if this is what I have to do, then I'm going to move to another state or go to my family or, you know, cannot keep up everyday living. Their life has been torn apart. You know, kids quit college, you know, not knowing what the outcome is going to be, not knowing if their dad is going to stay in this country or going to end up staying here. It really puts a mental anguish on you. I'll tell you this, I still have mental anguish. I cannot walk out at 6 o'clock in the morning to go to work without looking all around to see if anybody's waiting for me outside. And I can only feel their pain because I've been through it. And I kid you not, there's going to be a lot of people that need help when this is all over.
Are people being released as per Judge Goldsmith's order? Are you hearing from people that are getting out?
Yes, I've been hearing that people have been coming out. You see it on social media, people coming home. You see a little girl grabbing her dad and hugging him and kissing him, not believing. I'm talking about a 4-year-old that hasn't seen her dad in 18 months. hugging him and kissing him and cannot believe that's her dad. She grabbed him. She would not let him go anymore. She just literally just hung on to him. And it just breaks her heart to see stuff like that. And you know what? We all make mistakes. We've all made mistakes, all of us that they picked up. But I think we truly, in this country, we deserve a second chance. And this is the country to give it to us. There is no better country than this country. I would not dream of being anywhere in the world but this place. This is all I know. This is my heart. This is my life. My family's here. I brought kids into this country. I want to be a part of this country. I just need a second chance to show the American people that, yes, you make a mistake, but yes, you can change. You really can change.
Sam, I said it rounded you up and the others and wanted to deport you because of, as you say, crimes, some of them going back decades, or people overstaying their visas. And there are people listening to us talk right now who are saying, well, hey, they broke the law, so they should be deported. What do you say to them, Sam?
You know, I can't speak about every case, but I can tell you that, you know, we're a nation of hope. We're a nation of forgiveness. We take care of the world. You know, you're taking someone that's a Christian and you're going to take him to a country that he is not wanted. He actually fled that country. The reason they came without a visa is because they begged God to get him into this country. And finally, somehow they got in here. If that's a crime to try to save your family, if it's a crime to take care of your kids, to make sure they have a better life, then so be it. Let it be a crime. But the crime is so minimal. They didn't hurt anybody. They just came into this country to try to refuge, to try to make sure that they can get a better life, you know, and bring their kids up in a country where they know it's good and safe. And Christians are wanted in this country. We're not looked down on. We are one of the good people in this country, you know, whether it be Jewish, Christian, Protestant, all these people are welcome in this country, and we're part of it. We just want to be a part of this country. Give us a second chance.
Sam Hamama, thank you so much for speaking with us on Stateside.
Thank you. Thank you.
Coming up, pediatrician Dr. Jenny Rodesky looked at the most popular kids' apps to figure out how educational they really were. And she was surprised to find many of them focused less on learning and more on getting kids to spend money.
You know, if you're playing along and doing a coloring page or matching and all of a sudden an ad pops up, that totally steers a child's mind off course. And they may not even understand that that's an ad.
The hidden advertising in your children's apps. That comes up in 20 minutes right here on Stateside. You're listening to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Well, you know, they say prevention is the best medicine, and a healthy diet is a big part of that. So what if your doctor could write you a prescription for healthy food? Funding for programs to do just that is included in this year's Farm Bill, which President Trump is expected to sign tomorrow. And it was inspired by a program at Flint's Hurley Children's Center. Their young patients and their parents leave the clinic with a prescription for fresh fruits and vegetables, and they can fill the prescription at the Flint Farmers Market, which is right downstairs. It's all part of something called the Pediatric Public Health Initiative. Dr. Amy Sachs-Kustak is its nutrition director, and she's an assistant professor in the Department of Food Science and Human Nutrition at Michigan State University. I spoke with her earlier this year. So let's start with just what is the Pediatric Public Health Initiative and how did it get started in Flint? What's the mission?
So the Pediatric Public Health Initiative was actually created out of the water crisis, so the lead and water crisis that happened in Flint. Our fearless leader, Dr. Mona Hannah Atisha, was instrumental in creating this group of individuals who would serve to help our children fare better in the future. So creating evidence-based programs, evaluating those programs to offer a better future for our kids in Flint.
And when she was here talking about her autobiography, she really hit that hard in the book and in talking to us, how important it was to her that out of all of this came this opportunity to offer wraparound services and really get in there and support these children.
Absolutely. And I think the other really important part of the work that we're doing is that we are developing programs, implementing the programs, and then evaluating the programs. So then we can share the information that we learn about those programs with others in Flint, but then also outside of Flint, so that they can emulate some of the work that we're doing that's successful.
So the clinic, the Hurley Children's Center, this clinic was moved to the second floor of the Flint Farmers Market a while back, across the street from the city's central transportation hub. Why was that location important for patients?
Well, in Flint, we have a continual issue with transportation. So parents tell us that they struggle with transportation to get back and forth to the physician, also to access our healthy foods, our fruits and vegetables. So Hurley Children's Center used to be adjacent to the city hospital in Flint. It moved then to the top floor of the Flint Farmers Market. So it was really a public health nutritionist dream. So I walked into a situation where an area like Flint, which struggles with poor access to healthy foods.
So many grocery stores have closed.
Yes.
So many people don't have cars. I know there's that one bus loop, but
right.
Try taking kids and bags of groceries and wrangling all of that on a bus.
Absolutely. And so I think we'll get to this. But one of the things that parents told us was exactly what you're saying, that they may not have ever gone to the farmer's market had the clinic not been co-located with the market. So they actually told us that in interviews. And parents also talked to us about how nice it was to be able to get on the bus, be right across the street from their doctor's office, then to be able to go downstairs and have high-quality fresh fruits and vegetables.
Which leads to this prescription idea. Tell us about this.
So when I started at the Pediatric Public Health Initiative, this program had already been introduced. So Dr. Hannah and Tisha and I had talked about it. But when I came in, the program had been going on for about a year. So not only was the clinic co-located with the farmers market, but as an additional incentive to parents, the clinic was distributing fruit and vegetable prescriptions. So the fruit and vegetable prescriptions are given on Tuesdays and Thursdays. And then on Mondays, Wednesdays, and Fridays, when the clinic is closed, parents are given the option of either receiving the fruit and vegetable prescription or a farmer's market vendor-prepared bag of produce, of fresh produce. So when I came in, the program had already been going on for about a year, and I said what I'd really like to do is talk to parents. I'd really like to hear from parents about the impact of this program, and is this program doing what we want it to do? Are folks going down to the market? Are they actually buying those fruits and vegetables? And just ask them about their experiences with the program. So some of the things we sort of anticipated, so the parents perceived the impact of the prescription program as positively impacting their children's intake of fruits and vegetables, which was really important. They also had great appreciation for the program and for the physicians who they understood were going out of their way to do this. This was something extra that pediatricians didn't have to do. There was this feeling from parents that their pediatricians and medical staff really cared about them. And
they were responding to this.
They were responding to this, certainly. But I think probably the most important finding out of that research was the impact of the prescription program on food insecurity. So what we heard from a number of parents was that they were holding on to these prescriptions. So after several different iterations, the prescriptions have gone from $5 at the very beginning to our current $15 prescription. So parents were telling us that they would hold on to the prescriptions until they reached about $30 or $40. And at the end of the month, when their food dollars were short, they were coming back to the farmer's market and purchasing fresh fruits and vegetables for their families. So that led us to the thought that we need to expand this program.
Because you didn't want them hoarding them till the end of the month. You wanted them getting it all through the month.
No, and really that information let us go back to our funders and say to our funders, the dollar amount needs to be a bit higher. And so they agreed with us and they allowed us to increase the dollar amount of the prescription.
So what is it now?
So it's now $15.
I'm speaking with Dr. Amy Sachs-Kustak, who's nutrition director for the Pediatric Public Health Initiative at the Hurley Children's Clinic in Flint. And tell us what's happening in the bodies of these children who have been exposed to lead and water, or children who are food insecure. How do the fresh fruits and vegetables impact their health and their bodies?
So our kids were particularly impacted by the lead in water in Flint because of the fact that many of our kids are poorly nourished. So they have a number of factors working against them. Poor nutrition is just one of those factors. Our kids would have been better equipped to handle the exposure to lead had they been better nourished.
The bodies would have been stronger and more resilient?
Exactly, exactly. So what we do know about lead in the body is that it is stored in the bones. So fruits and vegetables, as most of us know, are loaded with nutrients and phytochemicals. Our children do better. Well-nourished children learn better, and they're stronger, and so they're better able to fight the lead exposure.
What do you do to teach good nutrition to kids and parents? In particular, I'm thinking of the Flint Kids Cook program.
So that actually also came out of our qualitative research project, so our interviews with parents. Something very interesting that parents told us was that kids, they love the prescriptions, but kids were going downstairs and primarily choosing fruits. They weren't choosing vegetables because they were unfamiliar with vegetables. They didn't know how to cook the vegetables. And many parents told us that they had hoped that we would offer something related to cooking, culinary arts for the kids. So some parents wanted it for themselves. Many others wanted it for their children. So I worked with the culinary director, Sean Gartland, at the Flint Farmers Market, and we developed a six-week program for kids to teach them how to cook. So that class is taught by Sean Gartland as well as our registered dietitian at Hurley, and it's designed around My Plate. So every week, the kids focus on a specific food group. So they actually just had proteins last week, and the week before, they had vegetables. They focused on vegetables. So these kids are learning a great deal about cooking, also about nutrition.
And the kids coming through your doors, they're predominantly African-American.
Predominantly African-American. The pilot for the Flint Kids Cook, which was last year, we exclusively recruited from Hurley Children's Center. So we signed kids up at Hurley's Children's Center, and then we had them enroll in the program and participate there.
And how does the program work to make sure that the dietary suggestions and the recipes are familiar and reflective of their culture?
So that's really interesting. So our chef, Sean, has had a lot of experience in Flint. So he's taught a number of classes for kids that are living in Flint. So he designed those recipes to be culturally appropriate for our population. However, at the end of every session, so these are six-week sessions, the sixth week, the kids prepare a meal for their families. And while the kids are preparing the meal, I talk to parents. So parents and caregivers sit in a room with me and tell me about their experiences with the program and what we should do. And then parents go and sit down, and the kids come in and they talk to me about it. So what we're really learning from parents and from kids are how we need to change the recipes a little bit and modify the recipes. So we had a grandmother in one of our groups tell us, I want to give you some of my recipes and have you take a look at those and modify them. So those are things that we are doing, and we're incorporating some of those suggestions, as well as the kids. The kids gave us some suggestions about things that they want to see too. And we'll continue to do that and talk to parents and talk to families about their inputs.
And we know from hearing Dr. Mona's very strong message that the fresh fruits, the fresh vegetables are so important for youngsters who particularly have been impacted by the lead and water crisis. So certainly you want to see this continuing just through the years. So how is this program funded, and how secure is your funding going forward?
That's a great question. So I gave a presentation about a year ago at a statewide farmers market meeting and was approached by one of the program officers from Michigan Health Endowment Fund about my work. And we wrote a grant to Michigan Health Endowment Fund to expand the prescription program. So there's a couple of things. So the Hurley Children's Center is uniquely co-located with a farmers market. Pediatric offices across the country are not so. What I continue to say is we aren't helping all the kids in Flint with this program. We're only helping the kids that go to Hurley. Now, that's a large number of children, but my hope was that we would expand the program, and Dr. Hannah Tisha is the same, that we want all the children to have access to a program like this. So we wrote this grant to Michigan Health Endowment Fund with the thought of expanding to a pediatric clinic whose population of children had never been exposed to the program, and to measure changes over time.
And as you said at the beginning, the whole idea is to share it with the world because
Absolutely.
You want this happening in as many places where there's food insecurity as possible.
Absolutely. So the point of this is really to measure, to see where this program and if this program is helping. And if it is, then we have the resources to say this is a program that works and it potentially could really be impacting our kids' dietary patterns. And what we know is that dietary patterns are established very early in life. So if we're able to introduce children to fresh fruits and vegetables early, the likelihood of that carrying throughout their life is good. And so it's smart to try to evaluate and expand a program like this.
Dr. Amy Sachs-Kustak with the Hurley Children's Center and the Pediatric Public Health Initiative, using food prescriptions to improve the health of kids in Flint. Thanks for sharing your work with us.
Thank you so much.
Today marks the first meeting of the Mackinac Straits Corridor Authority. It's the brand new body set up to oversee construction of a controversial tunnel beneath the Straits of Mackinac. It would house Enbridge's Line 5 that carries natural gas and oil from Wisconsin over to Sarnia, Ontario. In the weeks since the authority was formed, the public comment period has come, it's gone, and two of the three members have resigned and been replaced. As it meets for the first time today in St. Ignace, the authority is expected to move forward with the tunnel agreement. Kyle Malin is editor of MERS, a news service that covers state government. Kyle, this all seems to be moving kind of quickly. Why the rush?
Well, they have to get it done before Governor Snyder leaves office. There is a concern among the Snyder administration and Republican lawmakers that the new Attorney General, Dana Nessel, and the incoming new governor, Gretchen Whitmer, would not support something like this and would take action to try and shut Line 5 down. They're concerned that such action would propel the state into some lengthy legal action, you know, at best and at worst could impact the ability of folks in the Upper Peninsula to be able to access propane at the cost that they're getting it right now.
What has this rush resulted in?
Well, it certainly has resulted into democracy on fast forward. We saw the legislature quickly move legislation to create, first they were going to create the Mackinac Bridge Authority, give them the legal ability to oversee the tunnel construction by Enbridge. And when questions were brought up about whether that was proper and legal, they changed course and created a different authority, a tunnel corridor authority. So what happened is the legislature quickly passed it. The governor quickly signed it 45 minutes after the House did its final action. And by the next day, the governor had appointed three people to serve on this authority. You had mentioned also that resulted in two of the members ended up having to resign. That was because the vetting wasn't done probably as thoroughly as it would have been otherwise. One of the people who was nominated was a laborer up in the Upper Peninsula who had some pretty colorful things to say about Republicans in his time on Facebook. And once the Senate had found out about that, it was made clear they weren't going to confirm somebody like that. He had to resign. And then the other one, Mike Zimmer, who's the Snyder's cabinet secretary, he ended up having to resign because there was a question as to whether he was a member of the Bridge Authority and the Tunnel Authority at the same time, which would have been in conflict with the statute. And, rather than test the legal theories, he just decided to resign and let Governor Snyder pick somebody to replace him. So that all happened, you know, 48 hours, 72 hours after the Tunnel Authority was created in the first place. So been some volatility between the time it was created last week and today when they're meeting for the first time.
Indeed. And of course, as we know, the public comment period came, the public comment period went. And when you stop and realize what a major concern to Michigan residents Line 5 is, I think you'd be pretty hard-pressed to find a Michigander of any political stripe who doesn't have an opinion on it. How would you characterize the way the governor has gone about getting this tunnel and this tunnel authority pulled together?
Well, it's certainly been hasty and very driven. I think there's some real concern about what's going to happen with this pipeline. And there's also another underlying factor here, and that is a transmission line, an electricity transmission line that could be used or could be run through this tunnel to connect the Upper Peninsula and the Lower Peninsula. your listeners may remember a few years ago, there was some concern about energy prices up in the Upper Peninsula and the fact that they don't have much generation up there at all for electricity. And so the Upers were paying a ton of money on their energy bills. And the governor was looking at ways to alleviate that. But to get a transmission cord over the Straits of Mackinac was a pricey endeavor. Well, if Enbridge is going to be building a tunnel under the Straits of Mackinac that's 10 feet high, you could also stick a transmission line under there. So I think Snyder sees this as a legacy piece. He sees this as being able to put to bed a contentious environmental issue while at the same time solving some energy needs for the Upper Peninsula. And that's why he's really rushing this through. As far as government work, this is absolutely warp speed.
And assuming, as we do, that the authority will okay this and move forward with the tunnel agreement, how much does that tie the hands of the incoming governor and attorney general, as you mentioned, are not fans of this tunnel?
It certainly does tie their hands to it, because now we have a legal document that has been signed by the governor, approved by the legislature, and she is not going to have a sympathetic legislature to shutting down Line 5. It's basically the same as they or as Snyder has now. So her hands are tied. I think that Dana Nessel, the incoming attorney general, will be taking a look to see if there's anything that can be done to shut down Line 5 and validate what has been done. There's just been some testimony that's been given over here in St. Ignace that the attorney general's office right now believes that this has been sufficiently buttoned up for any legal challenge. So, you know, with Dana Nessel coming in, maybe she'll find something different. But right now, the legal staff for the state thinks that it's sound and nobody's going to toss it out.
Kyle Malin of MERS, thank you so much for speaking with us and filling us in on what's happening in St. Ignace.
Absolutely, Cindy.
Coming up, our friends at the Michigan History Center take us to a town where it's Christmas every day, and it even
has a 35-foot Santa greeting you as you drive through town.
That comes after the break. Stay with us. You're listening to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Apps designed for kids are as much a part of life today as Saturday morning TV cartoons and comic books were for their parents and grandparents. A lot of these apps are presented as being educational, which can help make a parent feel like a youngster's screen time is productive. University of Michigan pediatrician Dr. Jenny Radesky wanted to see just how educational these popular kids' apps truly are. And what she and her team discovered is troubling. Dr. Radesky, welcome to Stateside.
Thank you so much for having me.
So what put this on your radar screen? Why did you decide you wanted to study these kids' apps?
Well, when I was in training as a developmental behavioral pediatrician, I started to see this huge influx of apps marketed to young kids and labeled as educational. And my first thought was, really? Like, really, are these actually educational? I was curious. You know, it's possible that there's ways that technology can give us experiences that we couldn't get in real life, but there's a lot of technology that's way too oversimplified. So I had looked into who had studied this before. People had taken the top-rated literacy apps. I kind of wasn't interested in those highly curated literacy apps. I wanted to know, what are the kids really playing in the United States? Like, even the junk food apps, I wanted to know. All the free apps, I wanted to see paid apps. So we decided to really just survey Google Play. We chose Android and Google Play because that's the sort of devices that I have in my lab. And so we took the apps that had the highest number of downloads. So these are like 10 to 50 million downloads.
These are the hot apps. Parents are going to know these names.
Exactly. These are the ones that show up on the top of the app store that kids can easily download themselves. And so we wanted to play them and see what's going on in terms of the advertising content, which is just so distracting. You know, if you're playing along and doing a coloring page or matching and all of a sudden an ad pops up, that totally steers a child's mind off course. And they may not even understand that that's an ad. They certainly don't understand the persuasive intent behind the producer of that advertisement.
So you're looking to figure out, are these indeed educational? Instead, you found ads.
Right.
And you weren't expecting, right, to find the kind of ads and the way they're presented?
Exactly. We expected to see some in-app purchases. We expected to see some banner ads that, you know, were on the top and the bottom. What we didn't expect to see was really this high level of persuasion, trying to influence children's behaviors in ways that I felt was developmentally inappropriate. These were all apps that were targeted and advertised for kids 5 and under.
So little kids.
Yeah. A 5-year-old does not necessarily know how to read, much less understand, what do I do when this ad pops up? Or what do I do when, you know, Masha and the Bear is telling me, oh, you can get a better tool to help this sick animal if you watch an ad. And I just think that children 5 and under are so persuaded by rewards. They are so eager to solve little problems and feel that mastery, that's not fair.
Well, you're right about something that I, you know, as a parent and a grandparent, I got mad about this. When a child tries to cancel out, X out the pop-up, the character on the screen gets sad or even cries.
Yeah, we did see that in a couple of the apps where if a child wasn't making the in-app purchase, that the character showed some emotional reaction or some disapproval. And that is just not an appropriate relationship to have between a character who's in media and the child who's using that media. When you are a child, you are much more likely to trust the characters that come and communicate with you through media. You're much more likely to have some magical thinking and animism about technology. And studies have shown that children learn better and are more likely to follow the instructions of a known and trusted character. Like Elmo,
Olaf.
Exactly.
From Frozen. Right. So give me some 4 instances from some of these hot games that you've looked
at. Well, the first one we found was Strawberry Shortcake. And in this app where you're putting together a smoothie, for Strawberry Shortcake and her friends, you can put it together with the ingredients that they requested 2 or 3 times, and all of those ingredients are given to you for free. But after 2 or 3 times, if you try and make that recipe, some of them are locked, and you have to unlock them by paying 99 cents or $1.99. And if you don't choose those locked items, Strawberry Shortcake says, oh, that's okay, you can have it yourself. So they're actually showing this social, even a little bit of rejection of, well, you didn't follow my instructions. You didn't make the in-app purchase.
My jaw just hit the ground.
Yeah. And then, you know, we saw things like Barbie. It was more subtle, you know, compared to Strawberry Shortcake, who was just out there asking you to make an in-app purchase. You know, she might say, oh, I really like those sparkly shoes. But those sparkly shoes are locked. You know, there were cases like the rescue bots, where you can't solve all the missions and save all the people unless you unlock different levels and different items.
Do any of these tactics actually violate the law?
There is no law about in-app advertising for kids right now. There is laws about television advertising. And television advertising does restrict what's called host selling. And that is that idea that Strawberry Shortcake is a character in the media and at the same time is trying to sell you something. So on TV, if you're watching Mickey Mouse Clubhouse, they're not allowed to then have a commercial where Mickey Mouse is trying to sell you shoes or a trip to Disney or something like that. So because children are too easily persuaded by that character who they were just enjoying. Basically, they have taken all of these advertising design approaches. We found these interstitial ads that pop up automatically just when you're idle during the app. Gamified advertisements where you, if you watch more ads, you get more coins. There really needs to be a discussion about whether that form of advertising, which is very, very common in adult games and apps, whether that's appropriate for children, because children just don't have the developmental capacity to understand those things and to resist them. Children don't have that meta awareness that we as adults should have about when technology is persuading us.
And I dare say a lot of adults aren't as aware as they should be about how technology's using us.
Exactly. I mean, because it's designed to try to take advantage of some of our unconscious biases, some of our habits that we don't even think about on a very conscious level, things that are very like base of our brainstem. Oh, I'm going to go reach for that because I'm just, you know, feeling that urge that we're not even necessarily aware of.
If you've just joined us, we're talking with developmental behavioral pediatrician Dr. Jenny Radesky from the University of Michigan, whose study found that These apps for our kids, especially these preschoolers, are just crawling with these manipulative ads. So what do we as parents or grandparents or caregivers, what do we do about this?
I think this hopefully will just be a bit of a wake-up call for parents to always check and play what apps their kids are playing. I have two young kids. I'm as guilty of this as anyone, that I sometimes will just say, okay, yeah, go download that. That's fine. And I won't necessarily be sitting next to them. This has made me, I sit next to them, I watch, I see what they think when the app is trying to get them to change their behavior. It was really interesting doing this study all this past year. And my 9-year-old wanted to play FIFA Mobile, which does not have ads popping up all the time. It's just a game for you playing soccer against other people. But there were persuasive elements that would say, like, oh, come back in exactly 23 hours and then you can get extra badges. Or if you come and check us every single day and you get a streak, we'll give you extra points and coins. And so I thought, okay, I'm going to see if my 9-year-old can be aware of this. Why is this app trying to get you to come back every day? Why are they making you think about this all the time? You know, he honestly couldn't really grasp it just yet. I think the only thing that worked to make him realize it is that he started to realize that the game was getting boring because he wasn't making in-app purchases. He was just playing and playing and losing and losing. And then he realized, wait, this game might feel a little rigged. So that's one thing parents can do.
Yeah, because the cart, I think the tech horse is out of the stable.
Right.
We aren't going to get people to say, we're not doing apps, we're not using tablets or smartphones.
Right. And you can, I've heard some parents say, hey, this is why I don't let my kids use apps and smartphones. And in the American Academy of Pediatrics guidelines, which I helped write 2 years ago, we did say, don't feel pressure. Your kids don't have to get their own tablet or get their own smartphone early. This stuff is designed so intuitively, they'll pick it up quickly. If you want your kid to have some tablet and smartphone-based play, then look up ratings before you download. So look up ratings on like commonsensemedia.org. It's a great website. They've rated different apps. They'll give you like the top apps that they think are actually educational for different age ranges or for different things like social emotional skills or learning how to code. Parents should also just feel that co-viewing or co-playing should still be an important part, even though that smartphone is small and it's your child may be tugging it out of your hands and wanting to use it all by themselves. Really just sit there and watch what they're doing, because that gives you an opportunity, like I did with my son, to say, why are they doing that? You know, give your child a little bit of digital savviness, digital literacy, where they can recognize the persuasion that's often baked into a lot of these products. And finally, you know, I want parents to use their consumer power, that they have the right to just choose the media that really empowers them as a parent and suits their family's needs. So I've told parents, do a movie night where you get to pick a movie that you watched in your childhood, and then you get to sit there and reminisce and tell stories. And it's actually helping you feel more connected to your kids. It's not actually making you feel more separated.
And by the way, while movie night's going on, mom and dad, keep the phones down.
Exactly. <yeah. laughs> I know, don't use movie night as an opportunity to go
check
do
email.
Your work or check email. Actually sit there. Watch your child's facial expression as they're seeing. You know, we watched like Swiss Family Robinson the other night, and it was so funny to watch my kids' responses to something that I watched as a kid. I mean, also, it gives you the opportunity to say, you know, the way that they're depicting those pirates is a little bit, you know, racially inappropriate.
Yes. And we've learned a lot in 30, 40
years. Exactly.
Right. What's at stake here?
Oh, well, in the big picture, I try not to be too panicky, right? Because my job as a pediatrician is to support parents and not to judge them, not to make them feel guilty, but to really do research that's going to help them feel like there's some action that they can take. But the big picture at stake here is that if we power ahead just designing stuff for kids without pausing and thinking what's really best for them, we're going to be creating a lot of junk out there that kids, especially low income and working class kids whose parents don't have $3 to put down every time they want to download an app, it's going to create more of a digital divide, that you get more of these junk apps that are free, that are packed with ads, that may not be developed with an idea of really how children learn, in the hands of kids who are from different backgrounds or whose parents are more stressed or don't have as much time because they're pulled in a million different directions. The other thing at stake, I think there's a larger conversation about the ethics of tech design in general going on right now. You know, it's the tech lash of, you know, everyone actually questioning, wait, what are we all doing with our technologies right now? And how are they influencing our ideas and our behaviors? So children are where this all starts, right? Child development is how we develop our ability to reflect upon our behaviors and actions. It's how we develop relationships. It's how we develop the ability to tolerate those moments of boredom and distress that now we just fill up with little bits of technology and little bits of entertainment. So I would love for this to contribute to that larger conversation about, you know, hold on, let's think and really reflect before we put poorly designed tech in the hands of kids, especially in the hands of really stressed families that don't have the time to perfectly curate everything their kid comes in contact with.
Dr. Jenny Radesky, pediatrician, developmental behavioral expert at U of M CS Mott Children's Hospital. Thank you for sharing your research with us.
You're welcome.
It's an eye-opener.
Thanks for having me.
It is Wednesday, and that means it's time to talk our state's history with our partners at the Michigan History Center.
I've sent the following wire to President Truman. My heartiest congratulations to you on your election.
I'm aware of my blackness, but I don't go around and look and see whether I'm different than someone else.
Fail a lot quickly, and then eventually you'll succeed.
I worry that the person who thought up Muzak may be thinking up something else.
With the holidays nearly upon us, we thought it would be a very good time to talk about a town in Michigan where it is literally Christmas every single day. No, we are not talking about Frankenmuth and its famed Bronner's Christmas store. We are heading much further north to the Upper Peninsula. We turn again to the state archivist with the Michigan History Center, Mark Harvey, to explain. So, Mark, this UP town where it's Christmas all year long is...
Christmas, Michigan, not surprisingly.
I love it. So appropriate. So tell us about Christmas. Where is it and how big is it?
Christmas, Michigan is in Alger County in the Upper Peninsula. It's located on Highway M28 between Munising and Autran. So if you've ever taken the drive, the scenic drive near Pictured Rocks or on your way to Marquette, you would drive right through Christmas. Its population, I think, hovers around 400 annually. I'm sure that swells at different times of the year. And so it's a unique town. We're not the only state to have a town named after Christmas, but we might be the only one that has a 35-foot Santa greeting you as you drive through town.
No kidding. So you hit town and he's there all year round?
He's there all year round.
Oh, wow.
Well, so it's always Christmas in Christmas.
I guess so. And I notice it's in the Hiawatha National Forest. So I'm sure it's heavy, heavy on scenery all around.
Yeah, so it's near Bay Furnace. There's camping facilities there, and it's very close to Lake Superior. So I think it's a very beautiful area of the Upper Peninsula.
So give us the history. How did it come to be named Christmas?
A gentleman named Julius Thorson, a man from Munising, set up a manufacturing factory for small gifts on land that he purchased in that area. It was essentially a swamp, and most of that area is lowland swamp, sort of boggy. So he was able to set up a roadside shop there and named it Christmas because it was good for business to have a gift store in a town named Christmas, Michigan. So that he started it in 1938. Unfortunately, 2 years later, there was a fire that burned the whole operation down. But the town remained.
Yeah. And actually, I'm pulling up the picture as we talk, and I see that great big Santa right there to greet everybody as they come in. Does Christmas, Michigan have any special ways of marking the holiday?
Yeah, they do. Before I mention that, though, there was a very simple sign that would greet you when you would come into Christmas, Michigan. It was just a green sign that said, "Welcome to Christmas," and had an outline of Santa's face on it. And growing up driving through that area, that's something I always looked for. I didn't really actually look for the 35-foot Santa, but unfortunately, I think in 2015, that sign had deteriorated. It was probably one of the original signs that was posted up there. So it was sort of a tradition to mark your passing through the town. Again, if you're going too fast, you're going to miss it because it's not that big. But in 1966, they got a post office, and you can imagine a post office that could give a postmark saying Christmas, Michigan, what that did for people. So that's the enduring tradition, is that people would flock there to mail their Christmas letters. And also a fair number of letters were sent there addressed to Santa.
Fun. And as actually, as I'm looking at pictures, there's the Santa's workshop with the big Santa at St. Nicholas Avenue. So they're clearly leaning into this whole Christmas identity in a pretty big way.
Yes, absolutely.
Do we have any idea, Mark, whether Santa sightings are higher in this town of Christmas as compared perhaps to other towns in Michigan?
Well, I think if you just go by, you know, raw statistics of the fact that there's a 35-foot Santa there all the time, that counts for something. But also, quantitatively, it has to be higher than towns like Hell, Michigan.
A big thanks to State Archivist Mark Harvey for shining the holiday spotlight on Christmas, Michigan. And happy holiday to all of our fellow Michigan history buffs who listen every Wednesday for our history chats. Merry Christmas, Happy New Year, all of the good holiday stuff to you, Mark. Thank you.
Happy holidays.
And, of course, happy holidays to everyone from all of us here on the Stateside team. Today's show was directed by Lindsay Scullin and engineered by Bob Scon. Our executive producer is Joe Lindstroth. Contributors today are Mike Blank, Mercedes Mejia, April Van Buren, Sarah Leeson, and Bella Isaacs. Stateside is a production of Michigan Radio, a broadcasting service of the University of Michigan. I'm Cynthia Canty. Thank you so much for listening.